Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about virtual memory. So the way we implement having separate memory for each process we're running. We mentioned that part of our key idea was we did this address translation that the addresses our program uses aren't the real addresses on this machine. There's this mapping in between. And the way we implemented that mapping was by dividing up memory into pages. And by memory, I meant sort of the addresses the program could use. We divided those up into these pages. And the addresses that were on the real memory, we divided that also up into pages. And these pages would be fixed size chunks of memory, actually always a power of 2 size. So we could easily compute what we call page numbers, which was the zero-based index in the addresses of that page. And because we chose a power of 2 size for our pages, we can divide up all our addresses into a page number part and a page offset part. And the page offset says what byte in a page are we at. And we mentioned, okay, so if we're doing this, we have this kind of notion of an address space, the addresses that are available on the system, either from the program's perspective or the real perspective. We talked about what it meant for that to have a size. And there are kind of 2 issues that came up here. So one was that the size of pointers is not necessarily the size that's actually used for the translation. That, for example, on many 64-bit systems, they've decided it's not worth making all 64 bits of the pointer actually useful. So they'll basically ignore some of them for the translation process. Another thing is that often our machines support physical addresses that are bigger than you can actually use because we want to kind of design our systems around the maximum amount of memory they could have, but we don't actually have all that memory installed, so not all the physical addresses will be useful. But we still say our physical address space is as big as the physical address allows. You know, even if we try to use all those addresses, they won't really work. So then we looked at kind of our translation process. So we were going to take our virtual pages, the sort of pages that the program could see, and we were going to map them to physical pages. And the way we did this was we had this table of those mappings with 1 entry for each virtual page, and the entries in that table would tell us what the corresponding physical page was. And in addition to the identifier for the physical page, which is the physical page number, we also needed some other metadata. So we had a valid bit to say if there's something there at all, because very commonly when we run programs, there's addresses that you can't access. And one way that happens is that we'll have a page table entry for it, but it will have the valid bit B0 saying that's not memory that's actually assigned to your program. We also have these permission bits that the OS can give a program memory, but only let the program read it. Or they can have memory sort of in that table, but only have it accessible when the kernel is running, not when the program is running. And these permission bits make that possible, and how they work is that the hardware is going to check them when it does the translation. It's going to, you know, check before it lets the program access proceed. It's going to say, do the permission bits match up with what the program's trying to do? And then we started talking about something I'll generally call page table tricks. And that's this idea that when we have the program try to access something and the page table lookup says that's not a valid access and triggers an exception running the OS doesn't need to just turn that into a seg fault type scenario and usually kill the program. The OS has other options. And one of the other options we saw is that the OS can say, oh, well, that's where the program's stack should be, or some other part of the program's memory. Let's just put some memory there, since it makes sense to have that be accessible to the program. And the OS can update the page tables to put the memory there, go back to the program, have it retry the access that previously failed, which will now work. And in this way, the OS can kind of allocate memory lazily, that rather than sort of setting up all of the program in advance, the OS can just set up the program as it runs, which could be faster or, you know, at least makes the program start quicker. So questions on things we covered last time? Yes?
So is the like permission bits and like the valid thing, is that part of the page object? offset, or is that page separate?
So the question is, the permission bits in the page offset part of provision bits in the valid bit part of the page offset? No. So when we take our virtual address, which has a virtual page number and a page offset, we're going to take that virtual page number, use it to look up in this table, and get a page table entry that gives us, among other things, a physical page number, which I should write bigger, a physical page number, and we're going to copy the page offset. And here we have kind of the permission bits are part of that page table entry that we look up with the virtual page number. They are never part of the address. A reason people can be confused in this is, as we'll see later, we're going to store our page table entries, which are going to have a physical page number and some other stuff. And a way people commonly get confused is that, like, well, that kind of looks like our addresses, which have a physical page number and some other stuff. The other stuff in our addresses is the page offset. The other stuff in the page table entries are things like valid bits and permission bits. And I think that's one of the ways people get confused about this, is that we have two different things where we're going to care about physical page numbers, or page numbers and some other stuff. But yes, they're never in the virtual addresses. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it, because if we have the permission bits in the virtual page virtual address, well, you can set those because that's your pointer value. And it wouldn't make sense for you to be able to change the permissions of your memory. It has to be stored somewhere you can't change, which is the page table, because the OS sets that up for you. You do not have access to it generally. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I have another question.
Yes.
Is it standard, like there's a valid read, write, execute? Is there like always the same amount of permission?
So the question, is there always the same amount of permission bits? No, this varies between systems. I just gave an example of a possible set. And if you actually look up what's on different systems, it will vary. So for example, I think on x86, there's no read bit. It's just kind of, if it's valid and not restricted to kernel mode only, it's readable. Other questions? Okay. So I'll talk briefly about a couple things on the quiz. So quiz question 1D was saying, oh, we had this code where we were forking some child processes, and then there was we would insert a wait PID after the forks. And there was an allegation that this might cause child processes to wait for themselves. And in the code that was there, there was an exec call. And also some code to handle an error if that exec call happened. And execv doesn't return. So if execv is successful, it won't reach the wait PID because execv never returns, kind of like exit. It doesn't exit, it just goes to a different program. The other reason that wouldn't happen is that wait PID, it turns out, because you can only wait for processes made with fork, it will just fail if you try to wait for processes and you haven't forked any processes from the current process. Okay, and on quiz question 2, I screwed up and our proofreading process did not notice that there were 2 off by 1 errors, I should say. 2 off by 1 errors. But the intended pattern that didn't happen because of those 2 off by 1 errors is that we would start process for file 0, file 1, file 2, file 3. Then we would wait for 0, start 4, wait for 1, start 5, wait for 2, start 6, and so on. And the code we wanted you to fill in was that, oh, if we do this process, we're going to miss the last 4 at the end. We need to actually wait for them in order to have things be finished when the function returns. Because of off by one errors, I ended up not waiting for 0 initially, and so we needed to deal with that somehow, and also missed 5 at the end instead of 4. Questions about either of these 2 quiz questions? And on quiz question 3, most people got the solution here was that, oh, we were running a bunch of programs. Why could the system still be kind of not using all the cores we have? Like, a big reason is that one of them could take a lot longer than the others, and the others could finish. We just haven't waited for them yet, because we're running a bunch of different programs at the same time, and they probably take different amounts of time because they have different inputs. Yes?
So appending is file writing. So why would, how could these files be writing to the same file, these programs be writing to the same output file while being in different threads?
Question, how could the programs be writing to the same output file while being in different threads? That's not a restriction on Unix-like systems at all. Except that, obviously, at the moment of the write, there's going to be some order chosen. But probably most of what the programs aren't spending all their time writing. And if they are, they're probably not using the core, the actual CPU time, because they're waiting for the writes to happen. So indeed, you're correct that the writes themselves, like, will happen in order, but that's but that's not like going to affect the computations the programs do to figure out what to write.
So if like one of the analyses had a lot of stuff to write, could that also lead to this behavior?
Question, if one of the analyses had a lot of stuff to write, could that lead to this behavior? Yes, but the symptoms would more be that, like, because there would have to be so much stuff to write that the writes themselves are slow. And it actually wouldn't really matter that we have multiple things running. Does that answer your question? Because if the writes are slow, right, adding more processes is not going to make them faster. Just having more stuff to write, your writes are still slow. But yeah, maybe I should have thought more carefully about the nuances there, because that one isn't going to be. So with respect to question three, something I wanted to get to is that if we wanted to kind of fix the problem of like the programs working unevenly, we could wait for any process to finish once we started four and start the next one after anyone finishes. And that's something we can do by calling wait PID without specifying a specific PID and doing some extra bookkeeping. And I also should talk about quiz question six. So here we had 13-bit virtual addresses, and the most common problem, which I want to mention because it's going to come up a bunch later, is that the first three bits for a 3-bit virtual page number are those bits of a 13-bit number. And it doesn't matter how I write it. Those are still the first three bits if we think of it as a 13-bit integer. And a lot of people really wanted the first three bits to be, you know, the first three bits of like this, even though like that zero being there, you know, doesn't tell us where the beginning of the number is, because 13 doesn't divide by 4 evenly. You know, have to choose some number of hex digits to write, and it's not going to be equivalent to 13 bits. Sort of as I write things. And also, I generally don't need to write all the leading zeros when I write numbers, and I generally will not do that. Questions on this? And I'm saying this because the most common error was that people would take our address and take it like this and say, oh, that's 0001010101010, and here are the first three bits, and that does not work. Okay. Any other questions on the quiz? Yes. Yeah.
So you would ignore the first three zeros?
So if you want to treat it as if you want to figure out as a 13-bit integer what are the first three bits, you need to have it as 13 bits, not 16. And I guess there's two things. Like, generally, you know, I'm under no obligation to write a number as hexadecimal with the right number of leading zeros, right? If the address is 1, I'm probably going to write it as 0x1, not 0x001. Also, in this case, there was no way I could write it so it matched up. Because it's 13 bits, there's no way I can have the hexadecimal digits actually match up exactly to the binary, so obviously I didn't do that. Does that answer the question? Other questions? Okay. So I'm going to talk briefly about selected anonymous feedback things. Since some people have commented that we should focus on material, I'm going to be fast about this. So one thing, can I have people not talk while I'm lecturing? Okay, please don't do that. Complaints about the quiz questions only having one right answer and being worth a lot of points. So I guess a couple things on this that in cases where it makes sense, like this quiz, I gave partial credit for some of the wrong answers. Sometimes it doesn't really work. In some cases, we can give partial credit based on reading the comments. If you're writing something that's like related to what the question is actually meant to test, that is actually correct and like partial reasoning. But the main mitigation for this is that there's a lot of quizzes, is kind of the intention to make it not as big a deal. Though these other things should help. So then on, hey, could we have more examples? I like having examples. We have some things that make this maybe work less well out practice. So first of all, it's somewhat intentional, especially given sort of the breadth of material we cover and that we have a lab in this class, that homeworks and labs are where we expect you to apply concepts often for like essentially the first time. Probably there's a course design that doesn't do that, which involves having people actually prepare for a lecture. That would be something for me not to try to do in the middle of the semester. I agree I should have more interactive questions. And some of this is just a time management versus how far, like, because we're covering a lot of topics kind of not very in-depth. Asking about, I think this asked, like live coding and such. I'm not used to doing live coding, and I don't think that works well for many of our things which aren't very algorithmic. Also asking, hey, could you share the median, mean, and so on from the exam final from last semester? I put them on the old study materials page, the 25th median and 75th percentile, and also how a curve was applied to the everyone's grade at the end. So it's not a curve, because a curve is based on your relative position in the class. I do not do that. It's not based on how you perform relative to other people. There it is. You can download the slides if you want to actually look at them. Comment, questions on anonymous feedback, which I'm going through quickly since we move on to our space on demand. Okay, so last time when we finished up, we were talking about this idea that we want to supply conceptually a lot of memory to the program, like this big stack, just in case you're writing some super recursive code, but only fill it in as you use it. And our mechanism for that is that we don't actually set up the whole stack in your page tables, and you're going to eventually try to access part of the stack we didn't set up. Like around this push instruction that needs to access something on a page that has a valid bit of 0. And when that happens, well, the processor is going to say, that's not valid. Let's run the OS and ask them what to do with an exception. So this exception is actually known as a page fault. And the OS looks up what's there, you know, figures out, oh, that's where I told the program its stack was. Let's just fill that right in, go back to the program. It's going to rerun that push instruction that failed to run the first time. And the program moves along as if the stack was already allocated. The only difference is the timing is a bit different. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons why we recommended in the timing assignment that you might want to measure things not the first time they run. Because things like this will make it slower the first time. Yeah?
Am I correct in saying like, sometimes like segmentation faults like correct themselves and you don't even like see that it is a seg fault? Is something similar like this, would it ever not correct itself?
Question, in a situation like this, would it ever not correct itself? So we'll get into more detail later. So I guess I'm going to be careful about terminology. I'm calling this a page fault and not a segmentation fault to distinguish from the kind of signal. So this stuff like never even turns into that seg fault signal. Like it's totally invisible to the program when the OS can handle it. And there are situations where it can't. Sort of the simple idea is like if you're accessing something here or here, like it's not going to be handled. Other questions? And I showed, sort of as my example, the stack. So allocating space in the stack is basically giving you some empty space, like all zeros probably. This technique is also used for space that isn't empty initially. So for example, it's often used for loading applications. So rather than loading your program from disk into memory, the OS will say, well, that's where your program goes, and when you try to actually access your program's code or data, it will load it from disk as needed. Same idea, just we're not starting giving you an empty page, we're just giving it to you based on what file is supposed to be there. And when we do this to its logical extreme, we can start programs really fast. How do we start a program? We make an empty page table and start running. And the program's going to try to access things in the page table that are invalid. We'll just fill them in as the program goes. And this could be faster. It could not be faster, because probably, like, if we knew exactly what the program was going to access, it probably would be better to fill at least some of them in advance. But if we don't, we're going to avoid filling in things the program never uses. And often there's a non-trivial amount of code that is in things like the C library that you'll never actually run most of the time. And also, we can start the program faster, right? Because as the program's starting, like we can load just what it needs, and maybe we can anticipate what it's going to need later and start reading that while it's still running. And this is something OSs commonly do, with the mind of that if you want to care about your program running fast, you probably actually care, if you're a human, about it sort of starting fast when you start it, not like exactly how much, where the time is spent. And the OS can kind of hide that time by having the program do some stuff faster. That's going to be a win for you. Okay, so I mentioned this idea of sort of loading from a file, and Linux has an API for this that you've seen sort of in the context of the Signal Lab, where you use it for shared memory, that you can request to map a file to your memory, that have a file be part of your memory. And you did this with kind of shared memory special files, but you can actually do this with regular files. And this is what happens under the hood when your program loads a library. So you can open the file, make a call to this special mmap function, and if you make the appropriate call, you can kind of access that file as if it were an array in your memory. And those accesses will access the actual data in the file, both for reading and writing. And you might say, how does this work for writing? So for writing, this means that if you ask to read from the file in another way, it's going to access the same memory to figure out what's in the file. It's not going to go to disk unless we've copied it to disk. Yes, question?
So if you edit this data and it's still in your memory, do you then have to run a save function or something to get it sent to disk as well?
So the question is, if I edit this data and it's still in my memory, do I have to run a save function to get it sent to disk? No. However, it obviously, well, not obviously, but it won't be sent immediately to disk in general. It'll be sent eventually. There are functions you can run to encourage it to be sent faster or force it to be sent faster. But it turns out this is not actually much different than what happens when you write files normally. So on most OSs, it's not actually guaranteed that when you write a file and close it normally, that it actually goes to disk right away. Usually, most OSs give themselves between a few seconds and a minute before they'll actually guarantee that that's on disk, unless you make special requests, extra system calls to say, no, really, write this to disk. Yes?
And then
question, can I mmap a file that is larger than the amount of memory I have? Yes. And in this case, not all of it's going to be loaded at the same time. And kind of inevitably, if you like try to access too much of it, some of the parts you may have loaded earlier will have to be saved back to the file. Other questions? Yes. So the question is that in the single lab, you actually closed the file descriptor after we called mmap, and how did that work? And I think the easiest way to think about it is that mmap does something like duplicating the file descriptor internally. So you're closing the file descriptor copy, but there's now another pointer to the open file that will stay around as long as you have the file mapped. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is that call to actually save things to disk always called? Most programs don't do that. However, like shutting down normally is going to, as part of the shutdown process, make sure anything that hasn't been saved that the OS knows about is saved first.
But if I do a port shutdown, would it still do that?
But if you cut power, often you will lose data if you're too fast. Most OSs have kind of a goal of saving files. So saving the data within a small window of time to make the cutting power scenario less bad. But if you're writing something like a database, you're going to make, you know, where you really care about having, you knowing exactly what's stored on disk or other persistent storage, you're going to need to make sort of extra system calls to make sure the OS saves the things you care about at the time you care about. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have this mmap idea, and the way Linux internally thinks of a program's memory is basically as a list of prior calls to mmap, and they just have kind of special cases for things that aren't related to normal files. And you can see this if you run, if you look at the special files in /proc. So /proc is Linux's interface for accessing information about running programs. In this case, the cat program is reading the information about its own memory in the proc self maps file. And this file has a bunch of entries giving a range of virtual addresses. So this is address 400000 through 40B000. The permissions and this P, which we won't talk about, but stands for the map private flag on mmap. Talk about it more, as you say, and the file it corresponds to. So in this case, this is saying, oh, the cat program is loaded into memory at that range of addresses. And there's actually a couple ranges where different parts of the cat program are loaded into memory. We also have a region of memory that's used for the heap. So there's not a real file there, so it just says heap in brackets to indicate, you know, it's not a file, but Linux is basically saying, we're gonna handle the case of files and just have special cases for when it's not a file, but just like the heap or the stack and so on. So the heap, and here we have the stack, and here we have a bunch of things where we've loaded parts of a library and also allocated sort of empty space for like global variables and or dynamically allocated data and things like that. But this is how Linux tracks a program's memory. And this is not the memory that's in the page table. This is the memory the program thinks it has allocated, regardless of whether we've actually filled in the page table yet. So Linux tracks this list of what are in the kernel called these VM area structs. Our reading uses the term segments. which kind of say, here's the program's memory layout. We have from this address to this address, we have these permissions coming from this file, or maybe no file, and so on. So questions about this view of a program's memory? And as we'll see in the lab tomorrow, so this is kind of the logical view of the memory. As for filling in the page table, that's going to be done on Linux with that allocate on demand technique. So basically, when Linux gets an exception from the processor saying, this program tried to access something that wasn't in the page table, it's going to look at this and say, OK, what address was the program trying to access? And it's going to try to find it in here. And it's going to look at all these entries and see if it matches the address. And if it doesn't, it's going to say, well, that's a seg fault. We're going to kill the program, or trigger the seg fault signal at least. And otherwise, it's going to fill it in based on what's in this table. Questions? Yes? Can I talk more about the seg fault? So if our program, so if we have a page fault, the exception from accessing something that's sort of not valid in the page table, and let's say, so if it's for an address like, say, 0x60B123, well, the processor looks at that and says, oh, 0x60B123, that address here, that is in this range here, I'm going to satisfy that by loading something from Bincat. So that's not a seg fault, your program just runs normally. We just have the OS running to make sure that instruction can actually read the data from Bincat. On the other hand, let's say you access some different address, like, you know, this address, 0x70000. So the OS gets a page fault for that. You try to access that address. It tries to look for that here, and it says, huh, well, I looked here, and it would be somewhere in between these two. There's nothing there. So it's going to trigger a seg fault, which is usually going to crash your program. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, this list of maps is separate for each program? Yes. Yeah. Can we add a seg fault signal handler that adds a mapping whenever it doesn't have one? Yeah, you can try to do that with nmap. That is possible. It's usually not useful, but possible. So what?
Doesn't it help with debugging, though?
Does it help with debugging? So adding a mapping probably doesn't help with debugging, but doing some other analysis of what the program was doing would help with debugging, I think. There are cases where there are real programs that handle the seg fault signal in a way where they do add a mapping, but typically they're kind of doing something that the OS would normally do themselves. The case I've heard of this happening is with JavaScript implementations, where they write code that's going to access things that aren't loaded yet, and they load it themselves. So you can do it, but it's not very common. Other questions? Okay, so talked about kind of loading stuff on demand and this idea that, you know, we're going to have this handler for these exceptions that looks at what the data is. Now, there's some other tricks we can do with these page tables besides just loading things on demand, and we're going to talk about probably the most notable one, which is known as copy on write. And our motivation for this is going to be fork. So if we think of running our shell, like bash is the shell that's default on portal, so when you log into portal, it's what implements your command line. And if bash forks, we have two copies of bash. And we sure would like not to store actually two copies of all this memory. And there's some things which are easy. So for example, this code in constants, we don't need to copy that because it's read-only. We can make it read-only. We don't have to worry about having two copies of it, because they're definitely the same. But this global variables part, this writable data which has global variables, that seems harder, right? Because, you know, that could be different between the two programs, so it seems like we can't share it. But there's a trick here that, well, usually we don't change most dependents. That when a program forks, like your shell, like usually it's not editing its global variables before it, you know, goes on to exec or exit. So we can just have that be shared as long as it doesn't change. If only we had a guarantee that that data stayed the same between the two programs, we could just share it. And to implement this, we just need a way of detecting if the data changes, and we can have this strategy where we share it until it changes. But to do that, we need some way of detecting modifications. And page tables actually give that to us because of permission bits. So that write permission allows us to tell the processor that this memory is read-only. And it doesn't have to actually be read-only. So rather than making the program crash when it tries to write to it, we will make a copy when it tries to write to it, and then let it retry its write. So as far as the program's concerned, it's normal memory that's writable, just like our allocate on demand memory was normal memory that it could use normally. But the way that's implemented is that it's not going to actually work on the processor the first time the program tries to do that. It's going to go to the OS, and the OS is going to make it possible. So we think of implementing this. So let's say we're running a program, and I have part of its page table here. We have some page table entries which are valid and writable and have some corresponding physical memory that backs them, which I've given the page number of. When the program calls fork, we're not going to actually copy all that physical memory. Instead, we're going to have both programs point to the same physical memory, but we're going to mark the page table entries as not writable. And the reason we're doing that is not because we don't want the programs to write to that memory, it's because we want to detect when they do. So at some point, maybe one of the programs modifies those global variables, and they're supposed to have independent copies. We're pretending these are independent copies. They aren't actually, but we're going to pretend that. And when they try to do that, that's going to have a problem that the processor is going to say, oh, you're trying to write to that, that's not writable. And that's going to trigger a fault. It's going to run the OS, it's going to run an exception handler, and the OS can figure out, oh, this program was trying to write to this memory here. Let me look up what that memory was used for. And the OS can find out, okay, I pretended that this was a copy. And the OS can figure out, so this is not really a case of a program like trying to overwrite its code. This is something that's supposed to be a copy. And I can say, well, let's fix that now. We'll actually make a copy, and we'll edit the page table entry to point to that copy. And then go back to the program, have it rerun the instruction that tried to do the write. This time, the processor looks up that new page table entry. It's writable, everything works. So questions on this copy on write idea? Yeah.
This is enabled by having those permission bits be in the page table instead of like with the actual address.
Question, this is enabled by having those permission bits be in the page table instead of sort of determined statically by the address? Yes. Yeah.
Do we have to make a copy of the entire page table, even if it's
Question, do we have to make a copy of the entire page table? So the answer to that is more complicated when we talk about how page tables are actually stored, because page tables are, as we'll learn later, aren't stored in one big chunk. But practically speaking, we're not going to be able to share the same page table for very long, because the program is very likely to want something to be different quickly. The biggest example is probably the stack, right? If they have different stacks, different values on the stack, that means something in the page table is different. So yes, like immediately after forking, they could have the same page table, but probably that's not going to be really useful because we'll have to have them have separate page tables very quickly once they do anything with the stack.
So we can actually only copy a section of the page table.
So if we can manage to only copy a section of the table, yes, and what section depends exactly how the page tables are stored, which we haven't gone into detail about. And I'm not sure most OSs actually bother with that, even though it's technically possible. Just because I don't think it, I don't think it's worth, I don't, not, don't think most OSs find it worth the complexity. Yeah?
What's going to happen to
the original physical page address? So after we've made this copy here, we can see the old process could still access the original address, the original physical page. You might say, what if the old process writes to it? At that point, we could figure out, oh, we already made a copy. Let's just let it use the original as is. Would be probably be the simplest thing to do. And just flip the writable bit back to zero. Or sorry, back to one. That answer your question? Yeah.
Is it always the parent that will end up with the original?
Question is always the parent that will end up with the original? No. You probably depends who writes first. Other questions? Yeah.
Like now, if the parent tries to edit the same place, there's no reason for the physical page to change.
Now, if the parent tries to edit the same place, there's no reason for the physical page to change? Physical page to change? Yes. Assuming there's no other copies of the page being in use, yeah. We can just make that writable for the parent. Usually, OSs won't do it until there's a write, even though maybe you could do it earlier. And I think the primary reason not to wait till the program tries to write it is that it makes dealing with if there's multiple cores easier. So question, how do we know if we need to make a copy or not? So there's some extra bookkeeping that needs to happen in sort of the general case that I'm not showing. So I kind of showed it here as there's only two programs that are sharing the same memory, but in practice, because you can fork multiple times, and also because there's other cases where copy and write is used, like for loading libraries, this bookkeeping, you know, there can be multiple sort of processes all referring to the same page, and the OS has to keep track of that. It also needs to keep track of it so it knows when it can free up the physical memory and use it for something else. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this is what's used to implement fork, and this is why fork is not hideously slow. As most of you noticed in the timing assignment, the system function, which forks twice, is pretty slow, but it's not really, really slow, and copy on write is a reason why. So if we're forking, we're going to have, immediately after the fork, kind of two processes that have page tables pointing to the same physical pages that are read-only. And you know, if, let's say, the parent writes first, then we're going to make a copy for the parent to use of that page, of just that page, you know, rather than copying all the memory. So questions on copy on write and fork? And so as I said when I introduced this, this is kind of a general category of things I call page table tricks, that we can deliberately have programs have page faults or protection faults, sort of errors from things in their page table not being set up. And we don't have to assume it's really an error. We can instead say, let's fix the page table. And kind of the key thing the OSs do to implement this is that the page table is not the OS's view of what the program's memory is. We saw that list of maps in Linux. That's its view of what your memory is. The page tables are updated from that. And we saw a bunch of things you could do with this. We saw allocating on demand, loading data from files on demand, copy on write. Another thing that's commonly done and was actually the kind of original motivation for virtual memory and pages was that we can save some stuff to disk temporarily if we run out of memory and move it back later on. And this is commonly known as swapping. And you'll see some text introduce this as the reason for virtual memory, because historically it kind of was. These days, this is still a thing operating systems do, but it's not really that high a priority because the gap in performance between SSDs and hard drives and main memory is much bigger than it used to be. So this is not something you want to do as much as you would have wanted to do it in the 70s. We also saw that you can use it to detect whether memory was read or written. So we saw that we can use it to detect writes. We can use it to detect reads by marking memory as invalid. And this is handy if you want to figure out what things are worth keeping in memory and things like that. And that's something, if you take an OS class, you'll learn about OS is doing, like for files, like trying to decide what programs do I want to keep in memory versus what can I just load if I need them. There's some other things. So for example, if in debuggers, you can set watch points on variables. And a way of implementing them is to sort of mark the part of memory containing the variable as invalid. And when there's an exception for trying to access that, then you single step to examine what the program's doing. But when the program's not accessing anything nearby that, the program just runs at full speed. Another example that's kind of extreme that people have done historically is that you can use this kind of mechanism to implement shared memory, but between physically separate systems connected over a network, where basically you take the idea of saving stuff temporarily to disk, but instead of saving it to disk, you save it to another system across the network. And this is all enabled by this kind of design that the page tables don't need to reflect what the programs can really access. They can just be something we update based on what the program tries to do. So questions about sort of these page table tricks before we go on to what page tables, how page tables are actually stored. Okay, so let's skip over. So I guess I'm going to first mention, so we have a lab tomorrow, which is primarily about looking how Linux manages memory. So you'll see we have a program that you're going to modify, which outputs basically a more nicely formatted copy of that memory mapping before and after you do something. It also outputs statistics on the how many pages are actually in memory versus sort of just available if you try to access them. And also how much space is being used for page tables. We're gonna look at a few examples in lab tomorrow. It's the first time the lab is happening. I'm hoping it fits nicely in the lab time. If it doesn't, we intend to give full credit if you're working for the lab time and don't quite finish. And you get an in-person check. So let's skip ahead. So talk about page table storage. And we'll go to the next. So, as we alluded to when we talked about sort of real sizes of page tables earlier, we mentioned that page tables could be many megabytes. And real systems, especially 64-bit pointer systems, have huge numbers of virtual pages. And we need some place to store them. And the number of virtual pages mean we can't store the page table on the processor core. It has to be somewhere else. So where are we going to place it? Well, we're going to put it in memory. And it's going to turn out, on things like 64-bit systems especially, that that's still not good enough. That if we just stored it as a big array in memory, we'd run out of memory. So also, we're going to avoid storing most of the invalid entries in the page table. And as we'll talk about later, we're going to use a tree-like data structure where we can omit nodes of the tree where all the leaves are correspond to invalid pages. So I'm going to first talk about this first trick, how do we store it in memory? So what we're going to do is we're going to store, as in our first version of this, an array in memory of page table entries. Now our page table entries, we have these fields, and we need to somehow represent them in the bytes of memory. And generally what processors are going to do is they're going to represent each page table entry as an integer, And we're just going to divide up the bits of the integer into the fields of a page table. So in this example, the processor has arbitrarily chosen that the most significant bit is the valid bit, that the next several bits are physical page number, and that the remaining four bits are either unused or maybe used for other permission bits and things like that. And as I said, this is chosen by the processor because they're the one interpreting this when they do lookups. And we're going to have an array of these in memory. The processor needs to know where the array is. So we're going to have a special register known as the page table based register. And this is what the OS is going to set when it switches to a program. So this is going to contain a physical address, not a virtual address, because we don't want to have a chicken and egg problem where we need to look up where in the page table where to find this. No, this is going to be a physical address. And the processor is going to interpret memory starting at that address as a big array. In this case, because our page table entries are 16 bits, we're going to interpret it as an array of 16-bit integers. And we know how those 16-bit integers are laid out. So for example, this 0 here is the valid bit of the first entry of this page table. And these next bits here are the physical page number of the first entry of the page table. And the remaining four bits here are those other or unused bits of the first entry of the page table. And we can similarly say that we can do this correspondence for each of these 16-bit numbers. So this first bit of the second 16-bit number is the valid bit of the second entry of the page table, the one with index 1. And these corresponding bits here are the physical page number of the second entry of the page table, the one with index 1, and so on. And we can kind of figure out what the page table is from that array of 16-bit numbers. So we just have our page table encoded as a bunch of numbers, because that's what we can store. Yes?
Sorry, do the permission bits fall in the same area as the physical page number?
Question, do the permission bits fall in the same area as the physical page number? If we had permission bits, they would be in these other unused bits. And exactly where they'd be would be up to the processor. Okay. Yes?
Would you have multiple base registers in a four say? Or do you also only have one in a single
core? So question, would you have multiple base registers in multi-core setting? Yes. So each processor will have its own page table base register. Yeah. Question, when you context switch, we can switch inside this page table base register? Yes, and all the sort of normal registers like the stack pointer and so on. Yeah?
Sorry, is the virtual page number not in the...
So the question, is the virtual page number not actually stored in the page table? Yes. So the virtual page number is the index. So just like if I have an array, contains 0, 10, 20, 30, element 1 of the array is 20, but I don't actually store 1 in the array. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
Does this mean you have to clear out all the bits of every object for the page table? These registers now will have this as well. Like there's no
left. Question, does this mean that the OS has to set the whole page table, so the whole part of, part of memory that would be the page table starting with the base register to at least have the valid bits be 0 if it doesn't want them to map to something? Yes. So even if most of our page table entries are invalid, in this scheme, we still need to have the full size of the page table sort of set aside in memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So here's how we store the page table, and I kind of showed you the logical equivalents, but the processor isn't constructing that whole thing at once, all together. It's going to do it just as it needs. So what the processor is going to do is it's going to have the program running. It's going to get a virtual address. The program's trying to read memory, trying to load an instruction. You have a virtual address. We're going to divide that up into our virtual page number and our page offset. We're going to take the virtual page number and we're going to do an array lookup with it. So I've shown you kind of the math for an array lookup with pointers. So, but this here, this is an array lookup. And this, their virtual page number is the index into the array. And this is the start of the array. So here I'm multiplying by the page table entry size because, you know, if the index is 3, I want to advance by 3 page table entries. And it seems like this is a multiplication, which might be scary if you're thinking about this needing to be really fast. Fortunately, the page table entry size will essentially always be a power of 2, so that multiplication is really a shift and is very easy to implement in hardware. So we do that array lookup, and then we use the address we look up in the array to access memory. And we get back a page table entry that's encoded as an integer. So this is our page table entry as an integer. And from that page table entry, we're going to get our physical page number. And we're also going to get the valid bit and any permission bits. So we're going to check those valid bits and permission bits before we let the memory access happen. And if it's invalid, or we're trying to do a write and it's not writable, or we're trying to run code and it's not executable, we're going to run the OS instead of continuing. Otherwise, we're going to combine our page offset with the physical page number. We get our actual physical address that corresponds to the address the program is trying to access, and we send that to memory. So at the non-trivial cost of turning every memory access into 2 memory accesses, we've implemented our page tables, even though we can't store them directly on the processor. We'll talk later about maybe making it this less slow, because it seems like accessing memory twice as much is a problem, and it is. So there's a way that we're going to make this less slow, but for now, we've succeeded. We just are accessing memory a lot of extra times. Yes? Can I clarify the array lookup slash start of the array? Sure. So if our page table starts at this address and we have, say, 4 byte entries in the page table, right, the first entry would be at address, the base address. The next entry would be at 10004, then at 1008, and so on. And a way we can compute this is that this is the first entry is the one with index 0. The next one is the one with index 1. This one is the one with index 2. So to get the one with index 2, for example, that is the base plus the size of each entry times 2. And that's what we're doing in that sort of array lookup part of this diagram. Does that answer your question?
Definitely.
Okay. Other questions? So the question is, how do I take the page offset from the virtual address and pass it to the physical address? So you're asking, how do I know what part of the virtual address is the page offset?
Yeah.
So to know that, we have to know, we should know the page size, either directly or indirectly, because remember that this page offset here is which byte of page. So this is going to range from 0 to the maximum byte number in a page, and we can figure out what that is, and we know what the page size is. So if our page size is 4,096 bytes, it ranges from 0 to 4,095. It turns out 4,095 as binary is 12 ones, so it would be 12 bits in our case. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So since we know how that works in theory, let's do a little exercise. So I'm going to have a system where I have 6-bit virtual addresses and 1-byte page table entries and 8-byte pages. Since I have 8-byte pages, that means my page offsets are 0 through 7, or 0, 0, 0 through 1, 1, 1. So my page offsets are 3 bits. That means my virtual addresses have a 3-bit virtual page number and a 3-bit page offset. And my physical addresses are the same size, and the page offset size is always the same between physical and virtual, so they also have 3 and 3 split. And my page tables take up 1 page, meaning 8 entries, or 8 bytes, I should say. And each entry is 1 byte, so there's 8 entries, which makes sense because we have a 3-bit virtual page number to look up, so we hope that there's 2 to 3 entries to have all the possible virtual page numbers have an entry. And I'm saying the format I've chosen for my page table entries is that I'm going to represent them as an 8-bit integer, where the most significant bit is the valid bit. Sorry, the most significant bit is most significant 3 bits are the physical page number, then a valid bit, and then 4 bits we're not using apparently. And I have a page table base register, which is 0x20, and I want to translate the virtual address 3-1. So since my page table base register is 0x20, that means the array of page table entries starts here. And since my page table entries are 1 byte, that means this is the first page table entry, then the second one, then the third one, fourth one, and so on. So D0 is the entry with index 0, D1, the entry with index 1, and so on. And then E4 is the entry with index 4, and so on. So note that I have the contents of physical memory here. And we're going to have to decode the page table entries that are. So your task is to figure out how does the virtual address 0x31 translate given this. And a step I would find useful is first figuring out how the address 0x31 divides up into a page offset and virtual page number. So here's our page offset, and the rest is our virtual page number. Written as backward. Okay, who'd like some more time? It's not, I'll do start slowly. Okay, so not that many. So let me do sort of first step here. So the first step I did is I said, okay, I have this virtual address and we want to do this process. So the first step the processor did is it divided it up into our virtual page number and page offset. And we use the virtual page number for this array lookup. So I have my virtual page number here. It's 110, also known as 6. And I'm going to use that for an array lookup. And the way an array lookup works is I take the base of my array, which is this base register, 20, and add my index, which is our virtual page number, times the page table entry size. I'm told in the problem that the page table entry size is 1 byte. So this is going to be 0x20 plus 6, which is the same as 0x10 in base 2, times the PTE size of 1, because our page table entries are only 1 byte, since our physical page numbers are so small. And that's going to give us 0x26. And that's not the actual page table entry value, because if we look back at our diagram, what happens to that value is we send it to memory. So we need to simulate sending a value to memory, sending an address to memory, and getting a value back. So I'm going to look at this table here, and the way this table works is that each row contains the bytes at a range of addresses. So I look for 0x20, that's in this range here, 24 to 7. So this is 24, 25, 26. So that byte there is F6. And we know we only want 1 byte, but we have the number F6 in hex, and that's not a page table entry. It doesn't have, we need to figure out where the valid bits, the physical page number, all the other things in it. So to do that, we're going to have to use this decoding information where the processor here told us this is the format of page table entries. That they've decided that we're going to take our 8 bits and we're going to divide them up this way, just an arbitrary decision they made. So I need to follow that. So I'm going to take my F6 and I'll rewrite it in binary just because that's easier to follow the format that way. And in binary, this is 1111010110. And I'm told starting at the most significant bit, we have 3 bits that are the physical page number. So our most significant bit, as I write here, is leftmost. So these 3 bits are our physical page number. And then I have a valid bit. And the other bits don't matter for this problem. We just had some leftover space. And if we look at what the processor did, well, we're going to check the valid bit. The valid bit's 1. So we don't have to trigger an exception. We can keep moving on with the memory access. And then we're going to take the physical page number and combine it with the original page offset. So I have my physical page number of 1111. I'm going to combine that with our 001 to get our final physical address. And I can also write this perhaps more readably as 0x39. And if we're actually playing the role of the processor here and doing this memory access, we're not done yet, because the step we had after that is that we're going to send that final physical address to memory. So we're going to do something with the value here. So questions on my process for resolving this? Yes? Why is the page table size 1? We were just told that in the problem. So the page table size entries, page table entry size, that is. The page table entry size is up to the processor. And how is the processor going to decide how big it is? Well, It depends on what stuff it needs to fit in the page table. So here, right, the processor needed to fit this big physical page number in there, so it couldn't use one byte, it needs to use at least two. So processors will choose a page table entry size that's big enough for their physical page number and all the other bits they want to fit in the page table entry. And maybe they'll have some extra space just in case they want to change things in the future. And they'll typically round up to a power of 2. So page table entry sizes you'll see on like real systems are typically like 4 or 8 bytes because we have like 20 to 40 bits of physical page number plus some other bits. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah. What would we do if the valid bit is not one? If the valid bit is not one, we want to trigger an exception, run the OS, and the memory access we're not going to allow to happen. There's not going to be a translation. We're just going to say it doesn't work. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I guess I am out of time. I have on the slot, I have another version of this exercise, and then we'll talk more about storing page tables in memory and talk about what do we do when even this is taking up way too much space?